This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll have an update on the lawsuit at the Olympia Food Co-op.
This was a major victory for boycott, divestment, and sanction. And now the judge has hit the people who opposed BDS and sued the co-op with significant damages.
Rick Wolf joins us to talk about some of the current banking scandals.
The world has been in a serious economic decline, if not depression, for almost 5 years. Rick tells us whether that's going to get better, worse, or stay the same, and the scandals that have gone with it and been revealed.
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, the Manning trial is still going on.
I'm sure all our listeners remember who Bradley Manning was or is. Bradley Manning was the young private soldier who, according to the government, the allegations are that he is the one who downloaded and then uploaded to WikiLeaks hundreds of thousands of pages of documents, the collateral murder video, the Iraq war logs, the Afghanistan war logs, the State Department cables, etc.
And he's been charged with aiding the enemy.
Right. He's been charged with a 22-count indictment. It's not an indictment. It's a charge sheet. I don't think they call it an indictment. It's in a court-martial. And the court-martial is going on at Fort Meade. Fort Meade is in Maryland, and it's been going on periodically. It goes on every month for about 3 or 4 days on what they call preliminary motions, which are everything from what materials are they going to get to discover, what's going to be classified, what kind of instructions are the jury going to be given. And it's a tedious, long process going on at Fort Meade. And it's particularly tedious because this is like a Mickey Mouse courtroom, except that someone's life is on trial. He's facing a death penalty charge, although the government says it's not going to ask for the death penalty. I'm not sure whether the judge can give a death penalty. If the government doesn't ask for it, probably not. But in any case, he's facing life in prison. He's probably about 24, 25 now. He's been in for 3 years or so.
And is there a jury in this, or does the judge make the decision?
This is all judge right now. These are all preliminary.
Oh, right.
And they're going on every month, and they'll be going on for the next few months. The trial date is now scheduled for sometime between November and January.
And when there's a trial, will there be a jury?
Yes, there'll be a jury, but they're all military people. They're not like a real jury. I mean, it's
very formal.
Right. It's all appointed. It's
political.
And the whole operation is political. And, of course, there's objections because Obama already said he's guilty, said Bradley Manning is guilty. But we at the Center for Constitutional Rights, we've been monitoring the trial, sending people there, and particularly because the center represents both WikiLeaks and Julian Assange. And there's material that comes out at the trial that's quite important in terms of the WikiLeaks case. For example, there's these claims that by the U.S. and other people that, this will get into when Julian Assange is now asked for asylum, that there's no real investigation of Julian Assange going on in the United States. But at the trial, when they testify, and there's some testimony taken, when an FBI agent testified recently, he said, well, there's an investigation going on of the founders, owners, etc., managers of WikiLeaks. So you're getting material in the trial about WikiLeaks. But in terms of what's going on for Bradley Manning, it's this small hospital-like courtroom. I mean, it's just like a little antiseptic place. 20 people go to it. And what's amazing about it is there's no transcript that's available to anybody, except maybe the lawyer for Bradley Manning, David Coombs. We can't get any of the legal papers, even though they're not classified. They won't turn them over. The law students who the center has, they take notes as fast as they can, but they're completely overwhelmed. It's incredible that a man who's accused of violating the secrecy laws is being essentially tried in a secret trial,
right,
if we have to look at it. And so we at the center have filed a set of court papers trying to get public access to all of the public documents, so quote, public documents. And of course, we lost before the judge. We lost before the middle of military court.
The reason being national security?
The reason being they just don't even look at it. They just say you lost. They don't even give a reason. Mm. And so now we're in the highest military court. And it's like a 100% case. It's like ridiculous. I mean, there's no way we're going to lose this case in the end. But how long is it going to take us to win it, to get access to the motions, to the court papers, to a transcript, anything? So we're engaged in that litigation now. So that's one of the important pieces of litigation going on for Manning.
Michael, it's interesting that it has the appearance of being open because the public's allowed in.
And yet, as you said, you can't obtain any of the documentation.
Well, I'm a lawyer, and I've gone to the trial a couple of times, and you can't follow it.
Because so fast.
It's fast, plus you don't have any of the papers to read before.
Right. So it's sort of like they're speaking in shorthand.
Right. The judge will dive into the middle of a legal argument, and we have no idea. What's this about? I mean, what's going on here? Two interesting issues have come up in it. One, and I think the most serious, is the first and highest charge against Bradley Manning, and that's aiding the enemy. And the question is, how did he aid the enemy? What does that mean? And the government's argument is that when he sent the documents to WikiLeaks, and WikiLeaks was going to publish them, he knew that Al-Qaeda could read those documents. And those documents, therefore, quote, aided Al-Qaeda. Now, that's ridiculous. That you could charge the New York Times. When the New York Times writes an article about warrantless wiretapping or about, you know, secret U.S. bombing of Yemen, any article that the Times writes, someone in Al-Qaeda might read, or in any quote, terrorist organization, because the Times knows that everybody reads it. Why isn't the Times charged with aiding the enemy? And the interesting issue that it turns on is whether you know they're going to read it, or like it's more likely they're going to read it, or whether you have to intend to aid the enemy when you put it out. And the government is arguing you don't have to intend to aid the enemy. Just if you have knowledge that they're going to read it, that's sufficient. If you do that, Heidi, we're all indictable, every single one of us. Every newspaper, every publication, everybody.
And anything you put on the internet.
Right, that's right. Anything you put on the internet. If I make an argument, it's illegal to arrest people and hold them forever in Guantanamo, and you know people should be really angry about this, and then Al-Qaeda reads it. So it's a really dangerous argument that the government's doing.
But Michael, I wonder if this argument in the government's eyes is made easier because it is internet speech. Now, even though internet speech is still under the law, under Supreme Court case law, still afforded full First Amendment protection, I can't help but think with other recent developments that they're looking at the internet differently as a more immediate, perhaps more...
You know, that's interesting, Heidi. I do think that the Manning case and the WikiLeaks case were at the cusp of a cutting-edge issue about internet and about digital media and about privacy.
Right.
And that's why the government is coming down so hard. I think that your point, I think, is right, that they're really hitting them hard on this knowledge issue, even without intent, because they want to put a stop to people like Bradley Manning, who they allege they did this, and WikiLeaks. So I do.
And obviously, because it's easier on the internet to disseminate voluminous pieces of information, whereas in a newspaper, they couldn't in any way.
I think that's completely right. So we're at a key point. So key thing for Bradley Manning is this aiding the enemy charge, because that's what carries the death penalty or a life sentence if they don't give him the death penalty. And they're doing it under the weakest standard you could think of. So that's the key issue about Manning and what's going on right now.
And the center hopes to ultimately obtain some of the documents that you can't now.
We hope that our lawsuit wins. We would be surprised if we don't, because it's such a violation of the First Amendment. You can imagine going into a criminal court here, and every motion that's filed by the prosecution and the defense and every brief is not given out to anybody. I mean, it's a completely, I don't know what to say. It's like, it's not a system of justice. It's a system of a star chamber.
Right. Now, that raises the issue of what is happening in terms of Julian Assange's extradition to Sweden.
You know, we may have mentioned this before, but Julian Assange lost his final appeal to the British High Court on whether or not he had to be extradited to Sweden. The court said, I think the decision was 5-2, that he had to be extradited. And while there were a number of substantial issues in that case, in the end, Julian Assange lost. And he would have had to surrender and go to Sweden by July 4th or 5th or so. Rather than do that, Julian Assange took refuge in the Ecuadorian embassy. And here's what I think was going on. What Julian Assange, I think, understands is that whatever happens in Sweden, and there's no charges yet, there's allegations of sexual abuse, that he was going to be put in jail immediately in Sweden and not given bail. That's routine in Sweden. You never get bail on this kind of allegation, or any allegation, I don't think. You immediately go to jail. And that meant that the next thing that was likely to happen was the U.S. was going to ask for his extradition, no matter what happened in Sweden, whether the allegations never went forward, whether there were charges ever filed, whether there was a trial. Ultimately, what he feared was not what happened in Sweden. you know, the worst case might not be great for him, but it wasn't going to be life in an underground prison, right, like in the United States. So his big fear was ever going to the United States on an extradition, because here he would be treated like Bradley Manning was treated, and like we treat
alleged terrorist.
Underground cell, solitary, special administrative measures,
no
communications management unit, no due process, and never seeing the light of day and never being able to speak out. So he was very frightened of that, and should be. I mean, I think it's understood in much of Europe, and certainly I think in Ecuador, that if the United States ever gets its hands on Julian Assange, they will do to him what they did to Bradley Manning, and probably worse. So his choices were, either I go to Sweden and I get put into a jail and go to the United States, or I take my chances of trying to get asylum in Ecuador. And he made the choice to try and get asylum in the Ecuadorian embassy. And that's where he is right now, while Ecuador is considering whether to give him asylum. I want to talk about asylum for a second, but let's first look at the situation. So he, his choice was, if he goes to Sweden, he's basically done for. Maybe 90% chance of winding up in a prison here. If he goes into the Ecuadorian embassy, his problem is that even if Ecuador grants asylum, that asylum is good, but he's in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. And how does he get out of there?
Right.
Because as soon as he leaves that embassy, the British will arrest him for violating British law by not complying with bail conditions. So he has a long way to go before he gets to Ecuador and before he gets any kind of freedom. We don't know what's going to happen. There's many different scenarios here. There could be that Sweden guarantees they won't send him on to the United States, even on an extradition. But do you trust Sweden? Will it do that? I don't know.
Can you think of any other case that comes close to this in terms of comparable? Have you seen a fact pattern like this before?
No, this is like really unique. I mean, it's you never see anything like this, especially because what's interesting, the more I talk to whether it's Ecuadorians or others in Europe, the understanding of what the United States has become since 9/11. I mean, a lot was bad before. We had a huge number of prisoners, solitary, et cetera. But it's now well understood in the world that the United States no longer has any, even a semblance of justice, particularly around its prisons and its trials of people who they want to get. And so there's a lot of sympathy for not having Julian Assange sent to the United States in all these countries, which may mean that he might, maybe the Ecuadorians will grant asylum. I just want to say a word about asylum. Asylum is different various treaties and conventions, and there's essentially three or four grounds for giving asylum. One is political opinion, and you're persecuted because of your political opinions, and the other is a member of a persecuted social group. In this case, the center has been doing some work on this. We're relying on both, but really persecution because of political opinion. And you might say, well, but he's just publishing, you know, WikiLeaks is just publishing all of this once classified material on the U.S. corruption, U.S. crimes, etc. Why is that political opinion? And what's interesting, the precedents for this in the United States are actually quite strong. The U.S. gives political asylum to people from China, etc., all the time, who are people who go against their government to disclose corruption and to disclose crimes. And what they say is there's an underlying philosophy, political opinion of these people, that having sunshine or having these crimes put
brought
out
forth
into the open,
right,
brought forth, will actually change those societies. And so Julian Assange, if you were to apply U.S. standards to him, would be entitled to political asylum, particularly because the law they're going after him is the Espionage Act. The Espionage Act is almost entirely a political opinion act. It was passed originally to go after draft people who were against the First World War, including Eugene Debs, who did many years in jail.
What's also interesting is the fact that Obama has gone on record as praising whistleblowers and yet has been the harshest, as we know, in punishing them.
It's a very good point, Heidi. There's at least six whistleblower prosecutions that have gone on under Obama. There were three total in all other administrations in history. So he's doubled them in only one administration. So he's not good on this issue, not good at all. And he's the one, of course, who essentially, they came out yesterday again, and Bradley Manning's lawyer, David Coombs, said, he basically said Manning is guilty.
Any indication on how long it takes to determine whether asylum will be granted?
We don't really know. This is up to the Ecuadorians. I'm sure they're taking it seriously. Julian is now in not a very big embassy of the Ecuadorians in London.
And what kind of pressure is this government putting on the Ecuadorians?
Let me just say, the thing about political asylum or asylum in general, there's a UN declaration that talks about what asylum is. And what it says is the granting of asylum is a humanitarian and peaceful act, and it's apolitical. And then it goes on to say any country who harasses or puts pressure on a country for granting asylum is essentially operating illegally.
Interesting.
That's very strong.
But when has that stopped this country,
right,
Michael?
But let's face it, between the UK, Sweden, and the United States, we have little Ecuador. They want to throw it up against a wall. We don't know what they're going to do. Whatever they do is illegal. The question is, Ecuador, which is, you know, I think quite sympathetic to the politics and the revelations that Julian Assange and WikiLeaks brought out, is going to be under a lot of pressure. So it's going to take a lot of courage for them to do it. I'm very hopeful they will. But of course, until it happens, we don't know.
Well, we'll keep our fingers crossed. Michael, some while ago, we talked about how Visa and MasterCard cut off payment processing for WikiLeaks.
It was over a year ago that Visa and MasterCard said they will no longer accept donations for WikiLeaks. It was done, we believe, at the behest of the United States, or certainly was an indication to those companies that don't take money for WikiLeaks. During this entire period, you could still give money through bank checks in some way, or you could give money through the WikiLeaks Defense Organization, because that's for legal defense. But they cut off the main money that WikiLeaks was used to operate. And at one point, WikiLeaks was getting $800,000 or $900,000 a month in very small donations, $10, $20, $30. And if you look at the graph, which they have up on various WikiLeaks sites, after, of course, the banking blockade, it just went down to almost zero. And now WikiLeaks even says on its banks, on its website, that it's getting into its final money. It's not going to have any money left. A few days ago, they announced, though, that they now have a way to get money to WikiLeaks itself through Visa and MasterCard. And it's an incredible breakthrough. And you can see what that breakthrough is if you go to the WikiLeaks.org website. It's WikiLeaks.org. And you go to the donate button, and you will there be given instructions of how you can give money through your MasterCard and Visa card to WikiLeaks. And what they say on their website, they have now found some ways around the banking blockade, at least for now. And they encourage people to give money now through Visa and MasterCard before the United States again comes down to try and stop them. And it's through a French company. It's not important, the details, but through a French banking system, Carte Bleue, and they accept your Visa or MasterCard. And you can do this on the WikiLeaks.org website. So they consider it an incredible breakthrough because hopefully it will stave off WikiLeaks from going under or unable to function, really.
An important development, and let's see how long it takes the government to sabotage this.
Well, let's hope it can't, and that it can't just use the control of MasterCard and Visa, which control 95% of the financial transactions like this in the world or in certain countries. And they just do this. They're, quote, private companies, and they just cut people off, and that really ends their business. Interestingly, in addition to finding this way around the blockade, which, again, go to WikiLeaks.org if you want to find out about it, they also won a case against Visa and MasterCard in Iceland for illegally cutting off the financial lifeline of WikiLeaks. So there'll be more developments on this as we go along.
We follow up on the Olympic Food Co-op lawsuit filed over boycott of Israeli goods earlier this year. For listeners unfamiliar with the case, a judge in Olympia, Washington, dismissed a lawsuit tailored to force the Olympia Food Co-op to rescind its boycott of Israeli goods. The judge ruled that the lawsuit brought by opponents of the boycott violated a Washington state law designed to prevent abusive lawsuits aimed at suppressing lawful public participation. Interestingly, an investigation by the Electronic Intifada had unearthed that the lawsuit against individuals with the Food Co-op Board was also planned in collusion with a national anti-Palestinian organization called Stand With Us that was working with the Israeli government. Lawyers with the Center for Constitutional Rights argued that the lawsuit qualified as a SLAP, that stands for Strategic Litigation Against Public Participation, lawsuit. SLAPs are suits that target the constitutional rights of free speech and petition in connection with an issue of public concern. Recently, the five Olympia Food Co-op members who had sued to overturn the store's boycott of Israeli goods were ordered to pay $160,000 in damages. We get an update from Barbara Harvey, a Detroit attorney who has worked with BDS activists and a former JVP board member. Barbara, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Heidi.
Now, we've been following this case, but we have a recent development that's pretty good news. Can you tell us what happened?
Yes, I can. What happened is that the judge had before him the issue of whether to assess a single statutory penalty of $10,000 on behalf of all of the 16 volunteer co-op members who serve as co-op board members who were sued by the defendants in a case of overkill, or would the judge order individual statutory penalties to each individual defendant? And he decided to award individual statutory penalties to each of the defendants for a total of $160,000.
Before you go on, Barbara, Just I mean, we do this in the introduction as well, but just remind us of what this lawsuit was about, how you won it, and what phase we're in.
Yeah. The lawsuit was a suit by five co-op members to rescind a vote by the board of directors of the co-op, a volunteer board, to a boycott of Israeli products by the co-op. The co-op has a social mission as well as a mission to bring fresh food to the community. And the plaintiff sued 16 board members, past and present, and we countered with a motion under what's called an anti-SLAP law, which makes it unlawful to file a lawsuit that does not have any merit against people that has the effect of interfering with free speech.
Now, Barbara, I want to just also mention before you proceed, didn't it come out during an investigation? The lawsuit was also planned with a national anti-Palestinian organization called Stand With Us?
It has been reported in the media that Stand With Us is backing the litigation. In fact, Stand With Us produced a YouTube video of the five plaintiffs just before they filed the litigation, which basically explained their gripes against the co-op and tried to paint a sympathetic perspective for suing to prevent implementation of a measure that had the strong support of the membership, in fact.
So you won the case a few weeks ago, as I recall, and which is to say you won. The judge dismissed the case against the 16 co-op members. And then there was the question of damages, and that's what you were describing, that the judge inflicted. What was the total amount of damages now?
It's $160,000 in sanctions, statutory sanctions. That means that the judge has no discretion. He has to order sanctions. The question is, should it be one sanction of $10,000 or one sanction for each defendant? And so he ordered one for each defendant, 16 sanctions, $160,000. And the reason that he did it is because, first of all, that's how he interpreted the statute as clearly requiring. And secondly, because it serves the purpose of the statute, which is to discourage people from filing this kind of lawsuit.
Which basically affect people's First Amendment rights.
Exactly.
Is that right?
Right.
Let me ask, who's going to pay this? There were five co-op members who brought this lawsuit.
That's
against
a question. We'd like to know the answer to that question ourselves, because the five co-op members, it was reported to me, I wasn't present in the courtroom, it was reported to me that they didn't really look upset at being told the judge's decision. So if they're not upset, why not? And it suggests that maybe the cost will be covered from elsewhere, but we really have no way of knowing that.
Right. They could just be puppets for somebody else. We don't know. But let me ask you, what happens on appeal? Is there an appeal?
There isn't yet. The judge has not actually entered a judgment yet. As soon as he does, we fully expect an appeal, because, frankly, the other side has nothing to lose by appealing.
What's the significance of this victory in your mind?
Well, I think it has a huge significance because it discourages the opponents of the movement for justice for Palestinians to engage in this kind of litigation, which is intended to interfere with and stifle and squelch that movement by imposing penalties for lawsuits that have no merit and subject defendants who are just movement activists to scary litigation.
And we're talking with Barbara Harvey, who's been working with the people at Olympia Food Co-op, the center, as well as the National Lawyers Guild, to beat back a lawsuit that attempted to sue members of the co-op for being involved in the BDS campaign regarding Israeli goods. Barbara, I also know you were in New York last week for other parts of the BDS campaign, and this had to do with the big insurance company, pension company, huge company, the TIAA Kreft. And I know you've been involved in looking at what they do with their money. And there were some positive things, I think, that happened a week or two ago, I think, with TIAA Kreft. And then you were there for some meeting. So why don't you tell us what the positive thing was, if I'm right, if it was positive, and what else is going on there?
Yes, we are very excited about this, Michael, because TIAA Kreft, which manages financial assets of $470-plus billion, announced about a week or two ago that they had decided to remove Caterpillar from their socially responsible investing accounts. So it no longer owns Caterpillar in any of its socially responsible investing accounts, and that's because Caterpillar supplies Israel with these militarized bulldozers that are actually sold under Department of Defense contracts to Israel, which are used to tear down civilian homes in Palestine, and then the land is taken and given to Israelis, and settlements are built on it. So Caterpillar is sort of the poster child for divestment and boycott, and TIAA Kreft has done that. And even more exciting is that they did it pursuant to a decision by their own socially responsible investing screening company, MSCI, which delisted Caterpillar as an acceptable investment in any socially responsible account, which means that all of its other customers who use that same account will also be divesting from Caterpillar. There are many thousands of those other customers.
When some people buy stocks, they buy them through a social screen, mm-hmm. just to say they eliminate companies that are in tobacco or arms or other things. I guess that's what this is, right? Is this a social screen that has now added Caterpillar to its social screen?
Yes, it has taken Caterpillar off the list of approved investments. It's no longer approved.
So people no longer can invest in it, and I guess some people will start divesting from Caterpillar. Is that right?
That should be exactly right, because if they want to have a socially responsible accounts that meet the SRI socially responsible criteria, that is, they're going to have to remove Caterpillar.
Now, Barbara, is there a way to find out how that happened? Was it in any way due to public pressure?
Yes.
Do we have the movement to thank?
We have been working on this issue through a campaign that the Jewish Voice for Peace began, and that is now being coordinated by a group of five highly respected human rights organizations, with JVP as one of them. Our campaign is to persuade TIAA Kreft to divest from companies around the world that profit from the occupation, whether they're Israeli or French or U.S., any company that profits from the occupation we're asking TIAA Kreft to remove from their accounts, all of their accounts.
Caterpillar is a huge profitable company. Mm. And what does it mean that it's no longer acceptable on a social screen?
It means that investors, investment managers like TIAA Kreft, if they want to maintain socially responsible investing accounts, and this is one of the hottest investment commodities on the market now, are these socially responsible investing accounts, then they're going to have to adhere to the screens that are provided by these screening companies. MSCI is one of the very biggest, or the biggest, of these companies. It provides the list of companies that are okay to buy and put in a socially responsible investing mutual fund.
I have one last question on this. There is a relationship between what happened at the Olympia Food Co-op and TIAA Kreft saying Caterpillar is no longer acceptable on the social screen. Can you tell us about what that relationship is?
they're all part of a movement that is a global movement called by Palestinian civil society in 2005 called the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement. And they both represent decisions by different groups in U.S. society to honor the spirit of that movement, which is to engage in nonviolent economic resistance against the injustice of the occupation.
Well, it's great to see this. I mean, I would have said 5 or 10 years ago, this is impossible. The other thing I think about with this is, of course, Olympia is where Rachel Corrie is from.
Two wonderful victories on different levels, but connected.
And I know you've been with us for a long time, Barbara, so thank you very much, and thank you for being with us today on Law and Disorder.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Barbara.
Bye-bye.
Michael, we've talked a bit about the occupiers in Chicago who issued their own version of the Chicago Tribune and then were sued.
Well, what's interesting is, you know, we have talked about this. It's the Chicago Tribune is obviously the major newspaper in Chicago. And then, like they did here in New York, there was an Occupy Wall Street. In this case, there was an Occupy Chicago Tribune. Interesting, the Wall Street Journal, whatever you think of it, was smart enough not to sue Occupy Wall Street.
Right.
The Chicago Tribune, I guess, feeling they had a lot of muscle and a lot of money and that the Occupy Chicago Tribune would fold, started making complaints and saying, you can't keep using this. And then the People's Law Office.
If it was a real threat to their sales. And
as if people were going to get mixed up between the Chicago Tribune and the Occupy Chicago Tribune. The whole question is whether.
Confusing.
This confusion. Right. Are people going to be confused? Are they going to mistake Chicago Tribune?
Versus a parody.
Versus a parody, essentially, of the Chicago Tribune. Some very heavy letters were written by the People's Law Office, Michael Smith's nephew, Ben Elson, who represented the Occupy Chicago Tribune, along with the other people in the People's Law Office. Michael Smith, our co-host, helped them a lot. And they couldn't beat them back. The Chicago Tribune eventually filed a complaint with the World Intellectual Property Organization, WIPO.
Wow.
WIPO is in Geneva, and it's a serious business. It's a big deal, a WIPO complaint. There was a hearing before an administrative panel in Geneva, Switzerland. There were all kinds of briefs submitted, and there was a long decision. It came out a few days ago, and we just got notice of it, that basically said the Occupy Chicago Tribune can continue to publish as the Occupy Chicago Tribune. And it's huge because it's a victory against, you know, one of the most
biggest corporate conglomerates in the country.
And one that just tried to squash the Occupy Chicago Tribune.
Marvelous.
Like a bug.
Yeah.
And let me just say what the legal issue is. There's a paper called the Chicago Tribune. If I had said, put out a newspaper called General Chicago Tribune, using a generic word in front of it, they could sue me because then there is confusion.
Right.
And so what the Chicago Tribune argued was that the word occupy or occupied is generic, and therefore people would get confused. And what the court went on to say was this word is no longer generic the way it's used because there's a nationwide and worldwide occupy movement, and there's no one who would make a mistake. It actually becomes its own word.
It's become its own word. Michael, Daffy's, the shopping chain in New York, issued a flyer that said Occupy Daffy's, something about shoppers, and it was hilarious. But Occupy has now become a word with its own significant meaning in our lexicon.
That's exactly what happened. So it's no longer generic. The court describes, of course, how the Chicago Tribune has been there for 160 years. And then it goes to the website of the Occupy
right.
Chicago Tribune. And I'll sort of end with this. It's a great victory, let's just say it.
Yeah.
This little upstart, right. Occupy Chicago Tribune, has just won against incredibly heavy-handed
bureaucrats
from the Chicago Tribune and the very well-off elites. And here's what the site says, and it has a disclaimer on it. The Occupy Chicago Tribune site has a disclaimer on it so no one can mistake
right.
it. The active site, as the court said, includes a disclaimer that reads, I think they did this purposely to stick it to the Chicago Tribune, quote, "We are proud to have no affiliation whatsoever with the 1% Chicago Tribune or the Tribune Company." That's their disclaimer, which
That's
is great.
Wonderful.
Proud to have nothing
yeah.
to do with it.
Oh,
a great victory.
Beautiful victory.
A people's victory. So we've heard a couple of them today. We
yeah.
have Olympia
Food Co-op
boycott.
We
the TIA Kraft.
Caterpillar.
TIA Kraft Caterpillar, Heidi. And then the Occupy Chicago Tribune.
Three fabulous victories.
So soon we'll be on the barricades.
Yes.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Occupy the Economy, Challenging Capitalism is the title of Professor Rick Wolff's new book. We've done more than a dozen interviews with Rick Wolff since 2008, and a theme emerges. Beyond the corrupt banks and stock markets is a flawed economic system. A system that, at its worst, needed to change direction in the 1970s, when wages stopped increasing and the cost of living continued to rise. As we look around, the collapse has been coming down in steps, and many have been trying to dial back, save, and prepare for it. This, as millions have already lost their jobs, 401ks, pensions, and even their homes. Overseas, the waves of austerity to continue to push through Europe, as protests have erupted again in Spain. Professor Wolff joins us to talk about his book, Occupy the Economy, and about the increasing revelations of fraud plaguing the banking world. Rick, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much.
Now, you have a new book out titled Occupy the Economy, Challenging Capitalism. We want to talk about that, but after that, we also want to talk with a number of financial scandals that are really shaking the world. So tell us about the new book.
Well, the new book is an interesting venture for me. It is done in collaboration with a radio journalist named David Barsamian that you may well know, Alternative Radio. He did, over a period of some months, three major long interviews with me, which have been broadcast. And the response to that was so heartwarming to both of us that we went ahead and decided we would try to see if there would be interest in publishing a written version of them. To our great happiness, there was an immediate response from something I have always fantasized about publishing with, namely City Lights Books in San Francisco.
Lawrence Ferlinghetti.
That's right.
Allen Ginsberg.
Allen Ginsberg set up this.
He's still alive, Ferlinghetti.
Yes,
right?
He is.
And he is a major player in the City Lights Books,
right,
the store there in San Francisco, and their publishing house. So they decided to stop their regular procedures and rush into print in a matter of 3 months, just showing you what publishers could
can
do if they're
right,
committed to it, produce this book, which is the transcription of the three interviews. David Barsamian is a very skilled radio interviewer. He not only knows how to pose and sequence questions, but he's a super editor as well. And so I think what the book is an overview of how we got into this economic mess, why it's lasting so long, why it's hurting so badly, why government policies have in fact not succeeded. But it's done in a way that's easily accessible.
Again, the name of the book is Occupy the Economy, Challenging Capitalism, and it's by Rick Wolff and David Barsamian?
That's right. It has been told to us that it's an easy way, which we're very happy about, an easy way to get into this. The questions are short and to the point. The answers are carefully designed to then take you through a kind of a logical sequence of what the problems are and how to understand and think about them. An easy read, a summertime occupation that isn't going to tax your concentration all that much, and yet give you a lot of insights, or at least we try to believe that, into what's happening.
And certainly it's a topic that's on everyone's minds right
Absolutely.
Now.
Absolutely.
First,
okay,
want to get some of the salient points about the whole economic thing that's going on. We followed this with you for a number of years now. We have, of course, sort of flat in the United States, if you want to call it that. We don't know what's going on in Europe, really, or Greece anymore. We don't know. China seems to be exaggerating their growth. I don't know enough. But where's it going to go? Is it just going to, like, piddle along like this for a few years? Is it going to get worse? Are they going to artificially make it look better? What's going to happen, Rick?
Well, at this point, here's the consensus. The Europeans are in very bad shape. Their unemployment is higher than that in the United States by several points. A number of the economies in Europe are on the edge of major breakdown. Spain is already in that situation. Italy is right on its heels. Spain and Italy are enormously important major economies. This is not like Greece or Portugal or Ireland or Hungary, who are small economies. These are major economies that have the capacity to take all of Europe's economic situation down the tube. There is active debate in the highest circles of Europe, both critics of capitalism but also its leaders, questioning whether the European Union can survive, whether the euro will survive as a currency. It's not clear that that either of those things are going to collapse, but it's a measure of how serious the problem is. And the United States is more dependent and interactive with Europe than any other part of the world. There is no way for the United States to escape negative consequences that are already playing themselves out from what's going on in Europe. China is likewise. China is now, by its own annunciations, running at a rate of growth of 7 to 8%, which is half of what it had very few years ago. It cannot also escape the effect of Europe, which is its second most important market, and the doldrums of the United States, which are its most important market. Therefore, there is no escape. What the Chinese are trying to do and what their society enables them to do as leaders is to reorient the economy away from their dependence on exports to the rest of the world, because, frankly, that's not a reliable situation for them, and to focus instead on the situation at home. So to give you one index, over the last 3 years, as wages in the United States have stagnated, wages in China have gone up 20%. It's an extraordinary situation. They're doing that deliberately. It's not so much, as you might imagine, paying off the working class in that country for all that it has done, although it is having that effect. It's really more to create a domestic market so that the flood of commodities that the Chinese are capable of producing have a market.
Because they no longer can sell as much to the West.
That's right. And there's no prospect of becoming able to do so anytime soon. Let me then take it to the United States. If I had time, I'd talk to you about the slowdown in India, very sharp. The slowdowns in Brazil and Russia, very sharp. That's the BRIC. Those are the most important third world or less developed economies, all trending down.
BRIC is Brazil,
Russia, India, China. And sometimes they add a plural S for South Africa.
Right.
And when you say trending down,
output is shrinking, unemployment is rising, poverty is deepening, credit problems multiplying, and so forth. Because the world economy is going down, the price of oil is going down. And while that's a bit of a boost for Americans who don't have to pay quite so much for gas, it's a disaster, say, for Russia, which depends completely on the price of oil and gas and is in serious trouble now because that price is lower. Not to speak of the Middle East, where there are also severe consequences for a collapse in oil prices. Here in the United States, basically, the situation is this. There was great hope, above all by the Obama administration, that the so-called recovery that began in October and November of last year, 2011, would gather steam across 2012 and nicely lead into an election in November with an upswing that the president could take credit for. Being a little quick on the draw, they already took credit for it over the last winter. This turns out to have been a major miscalculation. Economists could have told them, many, that the prospects for a recovery being very robust or quick were virtually nil. We would be lucky, the good economist told us, if we had any recovery at all. What we had was a weak, limited, uneven recovery lasting roughly from October, November to April. It is now over. There is no longer that recovery, and it wasn't much to speak of. The last 3 months, we have increased the number of jobs less than the number of new people coming into the labor force, which is why unemployment is going up now, not down. And the prospect for the next 18 months is for unemployment, if we're lucky, not to get significantly worse. There is no chance for it to get better. So the president has had to readjust his campaign, focusing more on attacking Romney for being rich and doing all the things that rich venture capitalists do, because he can't take a lot of credit for the economic problems being solved, because we're not even close. And Romney has correspondingly switched by attacking Obama for not doing more on the economy, putting aside the fact that the single biggest obstacle for what Obama might have done, we'll never know whether he would have, but what he might have done has been the Republicans, who now, having prevented him from doing anything for this economy, now want to beat him up politically because he didn't do more. I mean, the absurdities that are on display here boggle the mind.
They do.
And so I think what we're at is a situation in which the American economy is moving along at a very low rate. The Federal Reserve, the International Monetary Fund, all the major institutions have lowered their estimates of growth this year to the 1% range, which is, again, not enough to solve any unemployment problem, not enough to get us out of the crisis. Let's remember we have an 8.3 official unemployment rate. Before the crisis hit in 2007, the unemployment rate was 5%. So we have it 60% worse than we had. So that's not a recovery. That's not overcoming a crisis. We're not even halfway back to where we were before, and the prospects of even keeping that level are slim. So the big hope for the last few weeks was that maybe, since the Congress is caught up in the election and will do nothing, that the Federal Reserve, which has independence from politics for that reason, would step in. So this week, Ben Bernanke, in his testimony before the Senate the other day, and basically has a position, we're not doing anything. And whether that's because they don't want to be seen as favoring one or another of the candidates, or whether it's because they're afraid of pumping more money into the system, which is really all that they can do, the end result is that the only institution that might have done something didn't.
He did say it was interesting. It may get much weaker. He said something
like that? Yes. It's a very bad situation. But when he says that, he echoes what almost everybody who looks at this, with the exception of a few people who are on the edges of the consensus. And it is very strange for me to say that I am part of a consensus. I normally don't find myself there in this profession. But right now, the consensus is what Bernanke said. Things are very poor, very weak, and we really have to be alert that the situation is actually going to deteriorate over the rest of 2012 and into early 2013.
But when he says that, doesn't that have a negative effect in terms of how people respond?
Absolutely. I mean, anyone who's paying attention, which I have to tell you is a relatively small portion of the American people, given what we don't know about economics, given the way economics is not taught in this society, given the fragmentary, erratic way bits and pieces come across the news, never explained in a way that people can internalize and make use of, more and more people pay no attention. But of those who do, all the signs are negative. There is nothing to point to. There's a little bit, if you're very optimistic, you can read the housing statistics as perhaps suggesting we've hit the bottom, i.e. it can't get much worse. Even that's being questioned by a lot of statisticians, but it's one of the very few areas you can look at all, and there's nothing else. The whole world is in a problem. Nothing has changed fundamentally here.
Okay, I know that that Heidi is anxious to go into all of the massive frauds and bank shenanigans we've seen. And we can number them one through, take out a sheet of paper, number from 1 to 100, but I guess we'll number from 1 to 6 today or so. But I want you to talk about that and what relation it has to the whole thing we've just been talking about. Is there a relationship, or are they just a little fraudulent?
I think we can go through quickly 4 major areas where the biggest banks in the world have gotten caught. I'm not going to say where we discover they're doing something, because in each of these cases, it's highly likely that they've been doing this for quite a while and that something happened to make them vulnerable to exposure. But before I do, let me answer your important question. What's the connection? I think the way to read what we're about to go through is to understand that when a capitalist economic system begins to unravel, we're in the 5th year of this crisis. It officially begins in December of 2007. That makes this year 5, and by the end of this year, we will have completed 5.
You know, I wouldn't have even realized that.
Exactly.
I mean, we...
That's an important number, because this was not supposed to happen. Right. We were supposed to have learned the lessons of the Great Depression to preclude this kind of an event. When it began to happen, we were assured, for example, by President Bush in the middle of 2008, that it was a housing crisis. It would be limited to a housing crisis, and we would quickly get through it. Nobody should worry. We've been reassured by Obama after Bush that this would be a short... We would get out of it. This would solve the problem. This is the solution. Nothing. And we are nowhere near the end of this. Well, however long it lasts, and no one knows, I can assure you, we're not at the end or anywhere near the end. And not only that, every major government program, the stimulus, the bailouts, has not achieved the goals that it said it could and would achieve. So in this situation, here's another sign. The biggest capitalist institutions in this country at this time, the banks, are in such trouble, are so worried about their own prospects in an economy in such difficulty, that what they are systematically doing is taking excessive risks, pushing the envelope of what's ethical and moral, and crossing the thin and blurry lines of legality. And when you do that, and you do it over and over again because you're desperate, because you convince yourself you might as well do this inappropriate thing, because if you don't, you won't be here, in which case, what are you holding back for? You're in a new situation. Things you wouldn't have done earlier, you got to do now. Plus, you're having a growing number of people who are willing to say, this is too much, whether that's a reporter in a newspaper, whether it's an angry employee who's going to turn whistleblower on you, or what it is, the number of people who see and are angry at what they identify as an expression of a system out of control and hurting them is growing. So you have...
That's interesting, because I think if you look at, you know, the banks that went under in the early part of this economic depression, really, and the anger at the banks and the foreclosures, and now you're seeing what we're going to go through, a half a dozen particular frauds or crossing the lines that are being exposed. It's almost as if people are so angry they're willing to let these exposures come out, really,
in
a way.
And then once they get out, they have a life of their own. So let's quickly go through them. First, and the one that's the biggest, because it's a planetary event, is this LIBOR, L-I-B-O-R, stands for London Interbank Offered Rate. Here's what it is. Starting in the middle 1980s, London, which had been for 200 years the financial center of the world economy, realized what we all understood at that time as economists, which is that the world economy was becoming dependent on credit in a way it had never done before. Every corporation was borrowing money all the time. Every government was borrowing money on a scale we had never seen before. And the really innovative thing was the mass development of consumer credit, not just the home mortgage, which had already existed for a few decades, but the credit card, which became a dominant phenomenon really only in the 1970s. And then the automobile that can only be bought on credit, and then the explosive of the last 10 years, student credit, the need for students to pay for their college educations by borrowing. To make a long story short, every transaction in the world, everywhere in the world, was being mediated, was being shaped by the credit conditions. So it became necessary to have a credit system, to have a system of rates. Every lender, and they're all over the place, had to figure out, what do I charge? How do we work this out? It's a technical problem, but it's also a practical problem. So a decision was made, let's have a universal benchmark, a basic definition of an interest rate that tells us what is the interest rate that the people who are the biggest lenders and the biggest borrowers and the most secure, what do they pay for borrowed money? And then all the rest of the lenders, your neighborhood bank, your local mortgage dealer, your crook on the corner, they all know that's the basic cost of money. So for my little business, I'll charge that plus a little to get something for myself. The LIBOR became the benchmark for the world. And here's how it works. Every day, the British Bankers Association polls the 16 biggest banks, who have offices in England anyway, what they are charging each other. It takes an average, and it announces that. And so they began to do this in the middle 1980s, and that number is a standard number. For example, variable rate mortgages in the United States, where the interest rate goes up and down depending on, those are based on LIBOR. So whatever the LIBOR announcement is, that's what you're going to be paying next month to your local bank for your mortgage. And it's factored into everybody's borrowing, more or less. So even if you're thinking about going into a store and buying a pair of pants, that store and the producer of the pants also borrowed money, which was also shaped by a relationship to LIBOR. What we now know is that the banks who provided this information figured out, this is not complicated, by the way, that what they said gave them, in a sense, an advance idea of what the announced interest rate would be. And if they said something higher than it actually was, then they could influence what the world's interest rates were.
Because the LIBOR rate would go up.
And then everybody else's
interest rates go up
as right. well. That's right. So the problem is that these biggest banks are among the biggest holders of debt instruments, derivatives of all kinds, obligations of all kinds, mortgages of all kinds. So you are relying on information given by somebody who has an active interest in the information they're supplying.
Right, because
that's called a conflict of interest.
Right. See if I understand that. They get every day the whoever gets the LIBOR number, there's some organization. What's it called?
The British Bankers Association.
Okay, the British Bankers Association calls these 16 big banks and says, what are you guys paying for borrowing from each other and from other banks? If the banks who are reporting raise that number, interest rates go up, these 16 banks are holding a huge amount of people's debts. That's they can right. charge those people more money in interest for the debt they're holding. And they make more money.
And they may be holding instruments whose rate and whose worth goes up and down with movements of the interest rate. So by reporting a higher than otherwise, they can make certain kinds of investments pay better than they would have if they had told the truth. What we now know is that these banks often reported an interest rate, here's what became the scandal, different from what they were actually charging.
This book is great. Occupy the Economy, Challenging Capitalism. Rick Wolf, thank you very much.
Rick, my blood pressure goes up whenever you're on because this is such maddening stuff, but you make it so easy to understand.
Yeah, well, you should. If you're not mad, as they used to say, then you're not paying attention.
Thank you, Rick.
I can't believe this. If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.